today, live, we are joined Kent Lee Platt from Math Bomb. I know, and I'll let you tell us a little bit about yourself, but did you create the RAS score, or was this something you've just been a part of? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? And thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, I did create it. I started RAS back in 2013. Conceptually, it was a couple years before that, but I didn't put anything into code until 2013, which was the Le'Veon Bell draft. Like I said, the idea had started a couple of years earlier when Von Miller was still in high school, just to give you an idea of the time frame. But in 2013, when Le'Veon Bell was coming out, he ran a 4.6 in the 40. And for a back his size, we know now, is not a big deal. Like, that doesn't matter at all. But at the time, the whole argument was that he was unathletic, and they kept repeating it over and over again. He's unathletic. He's unathletic. He ran a 6.75, I think it was, in the 3-cone, which is phenomenal for a small back, let alone a larger one. His testing numbers were actually pretty good. Even if you take his weight into account, and the 4.6 isn't a bad time either. But the argument was because of his 4.6, he was unathletic. And I really didn't like that that's how we were given most of this information. It was in superlatives and expletives and stuff, where people just say, you know, this guy's quick but not fast. This guy's explosive. This guy's athletic. This guy's unathletic. Those terms don't mean anything unless you can put something behind them. And RAS was an attempt to do that. It was the idea of taking a player's testing, comparing it to their position group, and saying, hey, 0 out of 10, where does this score rank, right? Where does this belong? Everything is stoplight color-coded on the cards. Everybody can understand stoplight color-coding, red, yellow, and green. And putting everything on 0 to 10 is also easy, because if you're 1 to 10, you got to figure out which one's good, right? Whether 1's good or 10's good. But if it's 0 to 10, 0 is never good. 0 is always going to be bad. So it makes it a lot easier to try to find that center ground and be able to contextualize everything much easier. So I built it out that way. I've been collecting data for a little over a decade and running this stuff. Everything got revamped in 2017, site launched in 2019. And now everything is online. Everything's up at ras.football. We have 26,400 players, I think, now. Dating back to 1987. So people can go on and check whatever their favorite player scored. We can compare them side by side now. We've got a calculator right there on the page, position switcher right there on the page for every player. It's been a lot of fun putting this stuff together each year.
Is there, as Brett rejoins us, thank you, Brett, for fixing your internet issues. We were just talking about the history behind the RAS score, the RAS score. Kent, is there a position group / a measurement that you found is the most accurate? Like, when you see that a certain position has a certain number in a certain area, you're like, I know that no matter where the draft guys have this player ranked right now, this is a guy that's either going to well exceed that or fall well short of expectations.
There's a couple. You don't want to get too broad when you're talking about testing, because players are different. Not every guard is the same. Not every wide receiver is the same. You know, you're never going to compare a Calvin Johnson or Randy Moss to a Cooper Kupp or an Amon Ross St. Brown or an Antonio Brown. Those are all very different players that win in different ways. But when we're looking at it broadly, the shuttle time for offensive linemen is a huge one. I actually have a study on there on my site about that. I wasn't the one that originally coined it. But the idea is that if a player has a good enough 40 time, and I think it's 4.47 or something like that, it's one of the best shuttle times that you can get. But if you're better than that time, the chances of you starting in the NFL are very high, regardless of what round you were drafted in. Late round guys that tested that well and shuttle had become starters in the NFL. So that's usually a very good indicator. We always like to point to the cone when we're talking about pass rushers, and it's usually a good sign when a pass rusher has a really good cone, but that also is pretty specific to a type of pass rushers, the guys that are real bendy on the edge speed rushers. Doesn't really matter as much for power rushers, so you don't really pay as much attention to it. But as a broad example, that's one of those numbers that we like to point to. Overall athleticism is huge for positions like tight end, tackle, defensive end, corner. A lot of those positions, you just kind of have to be a good athlete. Most positions, excluding tight end, being just an okay athlete is kind of a baseline. It's fine to be, to not be in that elite range, as long as you meet all your benchmarks and you're not a bad athlete. And I say except tight end because for the last at least 26 years going on, we haven't had a tight end under five in RAS that got up to 750 yards receiving in a single season, except for Jordan Reed, who was hurt at the time he tested, barely qualified for RAS, and spent most of his career injured anyway. And I think he only did it the once too. But you know, it's, you want guys that are good athletes, and it is generally shown to be a pretty good correlation to success in the NFL.
Yeah. You first of all, I'm glad I'm back. Right when I'm doing this great introduction for you, Kent, I see everything froze and I knew everything overheated. So I do apologize for that. But hearing you talk about tight ends and corners with the athleticism correlating to success, you mentioned that just sparked in my mind that it does seem like those are two positions where you just find contributors out of nowhere, whether it's late round, UDFA, early round, and it just seems like you just get these guys who are very athletic who aren't asked to do as much in college, especially at tight end. A lot of them are usually like a sixth offensive lineman for a lot of schools, Notre Dame, Michigan, Ohio State. And then you see them test and it's like, wow, what happened there? Like, is there in either, any of those positions you mentioned with athleticism, is there any player that you test that just came out of nowhere and you're like, he's going to be good? Like, maybe go back and look at stuff.
So we see it a lot at pass rusher. You mentioned tight end, and there's a very obvious example just because there's something notable about it today, which was Brock Wright, who was the second tight end in Detroit, just got signed to an offer sheet, and then the Lions matched it to bring him back to Detroit. He's had more touchdowns in the NFL than he had catches in his entire college career. That's not something that you normally see, but tight end is a position where it's very scheme dependent, and a lot of teams don't use the tight end as well in college. So you're looking for those translatable talents, those translatable skills. And a lot of those guys just don't get used correctly. Pass rushers, defenses in college can be weird. They can be finicky. Another guy that was drafted by the Lions just coincidentally was Ziggy Ansah some years ago. And Ansah didn't have a lot of production in college, but it wasn't because he was a bad pass rusher. It's because they would move him everywhere. They had him play end. They had him play a defensive tackle. They had him play linebacker. He played safety sometimes. As a 270-pound, eventually pass rusher. You know, you get a guy like that, and you start to figure, well, what can I do with him in the NFL? You want to be able to project what he can do. Danielle Hunter's another great example. He only had a couple of sacks in his entire college career and went on to be a perennial double-digit sack guy. Sometimes it's just they don't have the technique, and you got to train them up. That happens routinely year after year, and we have that conversation about how valuable is production versus athleticism, and there's not going to be a blanket answer. It's never going to be you value athleticism this much and production this much. You know, there's individual things that you have to look at for all of that and take all of it into consideration and not just one piece of it.
Makes sense. And Brett was rude enough to leave in the middle of your question again. We're talking to Kent Lee Platt of RAS.football. It's really interesting stuff. I've obviously seen tweets and seen the images posted, but I spent the last couple of days really digging into this. And it's fascinating stuff. Now, are you more of an analytics guy yourself, or are you an in-depth draft guy? Would you rather spend this time talking about prospects?
I love talking about prospects, but I'm mostly an analytics guy just because I'm pretty in tune with numbers. Numbers are my thing. I found that a lot of why people don't get into analytics as much is just that it's hard to make that type of information engaging. You start talking about a guy's tape, you're talking about the stuff that people watch on game day. You know, you're talking about guys that run routes great. You can show examples of them running these routes. It's very easy to get people engaged with that type of content. I'm not disparaging that type of content in any way. Analytics is a lot tougher to do because you're talking about quantifying data, and that even the term quantifying data sounds boring. It sounds like a thing you don't want to talk about. But it's an important part of any football evaluation. You should never take just the tape. You should never take just the testing. You should never take just the analytical numbers behind everything. You should try to find a way to marry all of those things together and to create a cohesive package of what you think a player is capable of at the next level. Because if you're just a tape above everything, testing doesn't matter, analytics doesn't matter, you're going to miss a lot, way more than you think you're going to miss. You're going to miss a lot. If you're just doing testing and you're like, I'm only going to draft high testers, you're also going to miss a lot, because there's a lot of players who have significant flaws on tape that you're just going to ignore and move on past. The Browns actually went through several years where they did that several times, where they just took guys based on testing and whatever analytics they had, and they didn't care about the fact that they had significant flaws on tape. This was the Johnny Manziel years when they were just going on a couple of different things. You can take analytics too far. It has to match the tape, and it has to be used as part of that tape analysis to really come up with a good example of what you think a guy can do in the NFL. And finding that balance is the hard part.
It was very interesting because I took a little time and I was looking at the Dolphins players on your list today. And one thing that stood out to me is two of the highest ranked Dolphins on there are two Dolphins players that Dolphin fans have grown quite frustrated with, in second round rookie Cam Smith, and then third year, I believe, second year player Channing Tindall. Those are players who rated very, very high in your system, but haven't even kind of been able to see the field for the Dolphins whatsoever. So when you see guys that are rated that high, I think they were both in the 9.58 range. They're drafted relatively high and then can't even remotely even see the field when the team is loaded with injuries. What do you think? Do you think that's just what the numbers can't calculate? Or do you think that there is a way that you should be able to factor in more of the not so obvious testing metrics?
And it could be. You know, I'm not as familiar with the intricacies of the Dolphins scouting practices, but sometimes you're just wrong about prospects. That happens to good teams. That happens to bad teams. Sometimes you're just wrong. Even teams that draft well. The Ravens are one of the best drafting teams in NFL history, and they have been one of the best drafting teams for the last two decades. But they've had misses. Everybody has misses. Sometimes they're obvious ones. Sometimes you draft a guy that's hurt. Example would be like John Ross. Had a lot of really great tape, fantastic measurables, made of glass, could not stay healthy, was a huge red flag before he got drafted. I remember at the time I tried to post all of his injuries in one tweet, and I couldn't because he had more injuries than there was space in a tweet to be able to talk about. You know, that kind of stuff you can't ignore. And sometimes it's just that you just look past that because coaches are arrogant. Every coach is arrogant. They all think they can coach up a guy and make them better. But there's a level where they have to be like, you know, I think I can, but I don't know that I would value that as highly. That's something that's going to take a lot more effort, a lot more time for me to develop. I'm going to need more work on that. That's part of the evaluation process too. So that's where you go from just evaluation to valuation. You're evaluating the prospect and you're valuing where you think they should go. And I think that's where a lot of the breakdown happens like that. It isn't necessarily that they're picking a guy that's never going to be good. It's just that they probably just valued the traits that he had incorrectly, or undervalued some of the things that he struggled with, and overvalued the things that weren't even really a question mark to begin with. So a lot of that stuff is correctable, and we got to remember that the NFL progression is not linear. You know, players progress at different rates, and sometimes they just jump. You take those jumps after year one to year two, year two to year three. But if a guy is athletic and then he still looks athletic but lost, the athleticism isn't the problem. It's the getting lost part that's the problem.
Of course.
So it's that kind of stuff you have to weed out when you're watching them.
I know you've been doing this for a long time, and you mentioned early that the Le'Veon Bell kind of situation, watching that, you knew that there had to be something concrete that you could come up with. Do you have a favorite prospect or a favorite couple prospects that you've covered? I see you smiling already because you're probably thinking of their names. Who are your couple favorite prospects that you've seen that they tested really well in your score and then became superstars in the NFL?
Well, there's so many. And I have a lot of favorite prospects that are on the other end of the spectrum
that didn't test well. Well, that was the next question. So you could throw both in there.
So guys that tested really well, I bring up Von Miller. Von Miller was a huge part of what inspired Raz before he was even in college, back when he was in high school. He took part in some Army obstacle course thing. I don't even recall. It's been. I mean, I'm old. It's like 150 years ago, back in the early aughts, whatever that was. But I remember some player who I don't remember did this obstacle course, and he was super winded and covered in sweat and given an interview afterwards. And then this other athlete came in and he did it in, I don't know, like half the time. And he was out of breath, but he wasn't like drenched in sweat like the other guy was. And he was given his little interview. And that was actually Kelvin Shepard, who went on to be a coach for the Lions. And then this other guy came in who looked like a mutant from another planet, because he is. Von Miller's not a real person. He came onto the field. He did this obstacle course in like nothing flat. And I remember there was one part where they had to get really low and go around this like post that was under a platform, and there was like little things hanging down. But they had to go, they'd be like get low and get around it. And he basically just stuck his hand in the ground and spun, you know, almost 360 degrees in a circle around this. And he was, you know, almost parallel to the ground. He gets up and does the interview, not winded, not anything, just completely unfazed by having ran this ridiculous obstacle course like it was nothing. And that was Von Miller. Von Miller tested obscenely well. I think he had a 9.97 or something out of 10. A lot of the guys you expect are up there. Calvin Johnson tested ridiculously well. You know, we have guys like that all over the place. Now, the guys that are lower, those are the funner ones, because this is where you get into the fun part of scouting. You know, if a guy runs a great 40 time and you watch him on tape and he's fast, there's nothing to learn from that evaluation. You just saw a guy who was fast run fast. When a guy tests poorly and ends up being successful, you get to go back and figure out why, because either you were wrong in your evaluation of them as an athlete, or the numbers were wrong, which happens. That does happen from time to time. Darius Leonard from the Colts is a good example. He injured his hamstring and threw his hamstring running his 40-yard dash at the combine. It's on tape. You can go watch the guy get injured on tape if that's your bag. But the point is his testing numbers don't reflect who he is athletically. He was injured and then came back and did his other testing while he was still in recovery. But then you have guys like Jarvis Landry, who had one of the worst scores of all time at wide receiver. He had a 0.27 RAS out of 10. And five of his tests were the worst of any Pro Bowl player ever. Like he's among some of the worst numbers that you could get at wide receiver. It's hilarious. I love bringing up his scores because you look at Jarvis Landry and you don't see a great athlete. You definitely don't see a historically atrocious athlete either, right? You don't see a guy who you're like, how is he even out there? That's how he tested. Orlando Brown's another example, tested just obscenely poorly, was allegedly corrected for loafing during the combine, which I thought was hilarious at the time. Put up terrible numbers, became a Pro Bowler in the NFL. And he's talked about how he uses his length and his understanding of the types of pass rush moves that players are going to use against him. He kind of plans and prepares really well for the players he's facing. And that's how he kind of overcomes some of those athletic deficiencies. But you still don't see a historically awful athlete when he's out there. So it's fun to go back and look at those guys and figure out, you know, how they're still successful. Love doing those kinds of tape studies. They're so much fun.
Ken, I'm going to ask you one more thing. Well, really, it's a two-part question. And then I'm going to throw it on to Brett, because I know Brett has a lot more football questions for you. But I've made it 20 minutes. And I haven't said anything, and I can't do it anymore. You got to tell us about the mustache, man. Like, you have to. What oil do you use? What cream do you use? When's the last time you shaved it? How did this start? I need more important than the football testing, I need to know about that thing on your upper lip.
I use oils, creams, and wax, depending on what I'm trying to do for the day and if I have to go anywhere. You know, there's a routine to try to keep the hair healthy. Any good facial hair, you got to do something to keep it healthy, or your skin's just going to dry up. I started this back right before COVID, so it's technically a COVID mustache because I grew it during COVID, but it didn't start during COVID. It started before. I was 38 or 39, whatever I was old, but not like I am now, obscenely old. Once you hit 40, you age at an accelerated rate. But before that, I thought to myself one day, I was like, God, I really wish I had a bowler hat. And I realized, like, I'm an adult. I can just do that. I can just go buy one. So I bought a bowler and I loved it. And I have it, it's in my car right now because I was out driving earlier. But I got that and I was like, well, now I got to grow the mustache because you gotta do the whole package. And then COVID hit and it was just like, well, I guess I'm doing this thing all the way now. I can't you know, go halfway. I got to get the whole thing. I put it on all of my branding at first when I first started doing my own logos and stuff. My little guy had a mustache and stuff on it. And I've just kept it ever since then. And people seem to enjoy it. It's always a nice conversation piece.
Yeah.
And I look pretty. It's hard. It's hard enough. You got to keep the ladies at bay when you do it. I'm making it even harder on myself.
I'm 34 years old and I can barely grow facial hair. So I am jealous of that. So
yeah, I'm not sure. There's a picture out there of me at a Dolphin game. It was No Shave November in college and the November ended and December 1st I had a thick beard and they told me to shave it into a mustache. That picture's out there. And I was told by members of my family that picture should not be out there because it's not my proudest moment. But yeah, no, it's very impressive. You definitely
I can't do a beard anymore. I've been very fortunate with my mustache not being white, but my beard is like stark white when I grow it out. So I age exponentially when I grow out my beard. So this is as much as I'm going to get. Probably until it starts to go white too.
Now, so that's natural. That's not dyed. No,
this is okay. Natural. I don't dye anything. And thankfully, the camera is very flattering. There's quite a bit of white going on up here too, but we're keeping it good otherwise.
Yeah, Ken. Just this is going to be kind of follow up some stuff you said earlier. You did mention Cleveland is going too far into the analytics earlier, and I kind of wanted to talk about that too as well. Because even going back to the Al Davis days for the Raiders, the talk was if you ran a good 40 time, Raiders were going to draft you if you ran fast. With RAS, who are some of the teams that after the RAS you look at and you're like, they are automatically going up higher up onto the boards for those teams? Or is there any team, like I tried to look at the Dolphins one on your site out of intrigue. And it seems like we have a fairly balanced in terms of RAS. But is there any specific teams that you see if they score really well, you know they're going to go a lot higher? Or if there's any teams that are going to be completely removed players from their boards with the athleticism?
Yeah, even the teams that do value it very highly, I don't think any team actively removes players who test poorly. I mean, we talk about it and we say stuff like that. But, like, the Packers, they love high-RAS guys. The Colts do. The Eagles have been one of the most athletic teams in the NFL for a while, and they've had one of the most athletic offensive lines for a very long time. They had the most athletic offensive line for like a decade straight. At one point, they had two guys with 10s on the offensive line, and they also had two guys in Brandon Brooks and Evan Mathis who were at 10 and the one right below that, but they were so close that they actually switched depending on which year you were looking at because they were so close. I think the Falcons are headed in that direction. They currently have the most athletic offensive line in the NFL. The Bears seem to be heading in that direction. Most teams, though, you're generally going to see a trend where they'll draft really high athletic testing in the first round, generally on day two also. Not all the time, but generally day two, they'll draft really high athletes. And then day three is where things kind of start to just kind of be like whatever. You know, they'll draft some guys that are high, some guys that are low. And not really be too concerned with it. And I don't think you have to draft a guy, you know, everybody on your team has to be those elite tier athletes. From the numbers, that's what you should do. But you shouldn't just use the numbers, right? We were just saying that. You gotta use the whole thing, marry the whole process. But you kind of want to find the guys you think are going to do the best for your team. Some teams just need to get more athletic. You'll see this a lot in rebuilding teams, like the Bears we were just talking about. where they're constantly drafting athletes. It's not just because they have this, oh, we got to get athletes. It's because sometimes you're bad because you don't have athletic guys. The Lions offensive line is one of the best in the NFL right now. And for a while, it was one of the worst in the NFL. And during that time, they were the least athletic line in the NFL, which was taken from us from the Bengals. And they have held on to that title since then. They have not relinquished it. They've had the worst one for, I think, almost a decade. They're going on. That teams have their own preferences, but it depends on where a team is at. And then you got teams like the Ravens, which, as I mentioned, are one of the best drafting teams in the NFL, and they don't really seem to have that many tendencies. And I think that's because they've figured out that valuation part better than anybody else, and they're able to figure out where they can value those guys, where they can get them, and then they jump on the guys they want, so they prevent them from falling any further or going to anybody else. They're okay with taking a guy that doesn't test all that well, as long as it's a guy that fits in their scheme, that fits with what their coaches are looking for, that fits what they're trying to do as a team, how they want their identity to be. They'll take those guys and not think twice about it.
Kent, question for you, because I do see now it's been almost a half hour, and you love to drop the Lions in while you can, clearly. So I looked and noticed that you're from Michigan, and we've now made it almost a half hour without Brett mentioning the Michigan Wolverines. That's actually, this is our 48th episode, I believe. And this is the longest Brett has gone into an episode without mentioning the University of Michigan. Are you a University of Michigan guy, or are you simply a Lions guy?
I'm not a University of Michigan guy. I'm a Matt guy. I like my Western Michigan Broncos and my Chippewas at Central, Fire Up Chips. I love my MAC teams. I love action in general.
The favorite conference of degenerate gamblers.
Exactly. I started my love for football through Randall Cunningham, actually. My mom and my grandfather would watch a lot of taped games, and they loved Randall Cunningham, so I loved Randall Cunningham. And then living in Michigan, I got to watch Barry during his peak years, which were all of them, if anybody ever watched Barry. He doesn't have any bad years. It's only peak years. But that kind of got me into being a Lions fan, and I covered them for several years, and I am more familiar with them than I am any other team. You'll find examples like the ones that I gave from anywhere, but because I'm more familiar with them, those are the readily available ones. Yeah.
Well, who do you want the Lions to draft? If you were drafted in the first round for the Lions, who are you going after?
I think they're going after a corner, a wide receiver, an edge. Depending on who's going to be available. The Lions tend to not care about injuries and at some point seem to target guys who have been injured. I know Kool-Aid McKinstry is a really big pick, a very popular pick for people for them right now. He has like a 7-something RAS, but he also tested knowing that he has a foot injury that needs surgery. So he hasn't been doing as much prep work as everybody else, and he's still got a 7, which for being a guy that's injured and barely prepping, that's notable. I think that's going to be a guy they're targeting. I think they're going after more speed guys like Xavier Leggett and guys like Brian Thomas. For edge guys, they usually like guys with length. Darius Robinson's a guy I think gets mentioned to them a lot. They like guys with inside-outside versatility too. Again, Robinson's a guy that does that. So there's a couple of guys that I like for them that I think they're going to go. It's weird because we're at the end of the round now, whereas I'm much more used to the team being awful and having to draft much earlier.
You're talking to two Dolphin fans. Trust me.
Yeah. But I was going to say, you're talking about the Lions offensive line too, and drafting. It wasn't that long ago, for like a 3-year period, the Dolphins drafted, 6 offensive linemen in the first 4 rounds, and only 2 of them became good. So
you got to hit on the picks. It's not just drafting them. They've also got to hit,
But you're talking to like, just to go back to the D-line as well, so I know you mentioned that for pass rushers, you definitely want to look at the RAS score. One of our producers who was not able to join us today, big fan of yours. We joke he's a rascal. We call him a RAS whore because
I love rascal. That's one of my favorite ones that people use.
Kent, it's crazy, and I'll let Brett finish his question. But he has been our producer, Mr. S, who he has been hyping you up. You would think that you wrote the Bible of football for him. And he was the one that set this up with you. He told us we had to interview you, had to have you on, and then messages us this afternoon, hey, guys, not going to be on today.
Yeah. But like, just to tell you, like, when it comes to RAS, for any defensive lineman, if they are yellow or red, he immediately takes them off his board. He's like, you have to go with a defensive lineman who have juice. So he will not even – just an example, when we drafted Raekwon Davis, who's gone, he's like, that was a waste of a pick. Second round, you have to do juice. But there are players he looks at that I'm like, I don't see it on the tape. The Penn State rusher that the Ravens drafted a couple of years ago, I was like, he's not productive. But he's like, you got to risk it because they have the juice and you got to work with it. And so you mentioned with athleticism. So is that a really correlation you've seen? Like, if they are not any position on D-line, they have to have that athleticism.
I wouldn't say any position, but most of them. If you're looking for a guy on the edge, almost always you're looking for a guy with the best athletic traits. And I mentioned earlier about the different types of guys. Regardless of what type you're looking for, you want them to have high ranking traits in those areas. There aren't a lot of low tier athletic testers who become productive pass rushers. There's a few, but not many. And a couple of them were undrafted guys. Shaq, what's his name from the Buccaneers, who I'm blanking on at the moment.
Barrett.
Yeah, he's now with the Dolphins.
Oh, is he? I didn't know that. But not a very good tester, but he was also an undrafted free agent. He didn't even get drafted. You want a guy that has a lot of athleticism because they're going against offensive tackles who are some of the most athletic human beings in existence. Offensive tackles are wildly athletic to the point where it's obscene. So you want to get guys that can counter that. On the interior, if you want an interior pass rusher, you want the same type of thing. You want a guy that's explosive. You want a guy that's quick. You want a guy that can burst through the line. But if you're looking at a nose tackle, you want a guy who's athletic for his size. Which for nose tackles is generally just not athletic. Nose tackles are they're not very good testers. For nose tackles, you don't care about their 40-yard dash or any other splits. You don't care about their agility testing, and that is literally half of the metrics that you don't really care about. You're going to care about their weight. You don't really care about height because it doesn't really matter how tall they are. It matters how long they are, so you pay attention to their wingspan, their arm length. Weight has to be good, again. Bench is usually a good thing to look for, guys that have good bench, because you want guys that are stronger. And then broad, vert doesn't matter either. So you have a total of three metrics that may matter for a nose tackle. If you can get a nose tackle that has a good 10-yard split, awesome. If you can get a nose tackle that has a good cone, also awesome. But if you can't, as long as they're not an obscenely bad athlete, and in this case I'm talking like one on RAS scale, like that bad, then it's usually not that much of an issue for a nose tackle. Nose tackle's job is to take up space and eat up blockers. And you can do that without having to go very far. And that tends to work out for a lot of teams. The Lions just signed DJ Reader, and that was the big thing. I had to go through that. We have Tavondre Sweat coming out in this draft, who almost has a 5 RAS. He's under 5, he's in the 4s. But for a guy that's 366 pounds, that's like an incredible level of athleticism for a guy that big. By the scoring, it's below average, but looking at it in context, that is not a below average athlete. The numbers work out that way because RAS is tailored by position, and defensive tackle is a broad position group, just like wide receiver is a broad position group. We don't have it split out by different types of receivers. That is something we're looking to add. We haven't yet, but you got to pay a little bit more attention to the numbers than that. If a guy tests poorly, but he plays a position where it doesn't matter quite as much, like nose tackle, that's okay. And it's even okay at positions where it does matter if he has the traits that he wins with. Cooper Kupp is a very good example of that. Didn't have a very good score, but he's not a burner, so you don't really care about his 40-yard dash. Has great agility, and what does he do well? He's super quick, he's super agile, and he runs a billion routes. He wins in the areas that he tested well at, and you're able to project that into the NFL. He's a guy that you can look at and be like, I think that his talents will transfer to the NFL. I don't think his 40-yard dash is going to be an inhibiting factor because he ran like a 4.62 or a 4.64, which isn't good, obviously, but it's not like a 4.8. Like, it's not something that's going to be like, I don't think he can run at all against NFL corners. You're like, I think he can run. He's not going to burn anybody. But he can use his quickness and still win, and that's what we need him to do. So even though he didn't test obscenely well overall, he did well in the areas that he wins at. That's what you're looking for, is guys that win in the areas that they test well at, because that's what you're putting that tape and that testing together and saying, this is projectable. I can project this in a good way.
Yep. The reason I brought up the defensive line too is the producer we were talking about, he disagrees so much with Jordan and I on Tavondre Sweat. So I'm glad he kind of gave Sweat a highlight there. Sweat is a person he wouldn't touch at all. And I'm like, when you look at what Sweat does, especially when we're kind of transitioning to more of a 3-4, I think he's a great day two pick. And
what's funny, Brett, is as you guys are both mentioning Tavondre Sweat, and Brett, you know me decently well, Tavondre Sweat's name is on my second screen right here with his RAS score pulled up. But I mean, he's relatively low everywhere other than what I guess would be a 10-yard split. When you look at that size and what the Dolphins, specifically Anthony Weaver, are going to ask that zero tech to do, I don't think you could find a better fit in this draft. Now, do you have other needs? Yes. Are there guys on day three you could put in there? Yes. But I think Tavondre Sweat, if put into the right situation, can be a really good football player.
Yeah, I think if you put him anywhere other than the nose, that's you being wrong, right? Yeah. That's you making a mistake in how you're using the player. I think the biggest issue that he runs into is that valuation portion about how do you value a player like that. And nose tackles are tough because some defenses rely very heavily on a strong nose tackle performance. I remember the Jets when they had what's his name as the head coach. God, I can't remember anybody today. But they ran a scheme where they had Mike DeVito was their nose tackle, and that whole defense ran through him. He didn't do anything. He didn't show up on the stat sheet a whole lot, but the moment he took a play off, the offenses just destroyed him. They were able to wreck that team whenever he wasn't on the field because the nose tackle is such an important linchpin for how they do line assignments, how opponents are calling their blocking against that defense. Taking into account what the nose tackle's going to be doing and how many blockers are going to be tied up by him is an important part of that because you can just tear up a defense that way or an offense that way. So it depends on the scheme that you're in for how high those guys are going to be valued. Generally, the guys that get drafted really high for nose tackles are like the super athletic nose tackles, which are rare. That's your Vita Veas, your Dexter Lawrence, guys like that. Those guys don't come along very often. They almost always get drafted highly when they do, but it's not super common.
Yeah. Of course, going to D-line too, I think I got burned. Last one I got burned and where I started to go more with the juice, the RAS on the D-line is Charles Harris, who I know you're familiar with now at Detroit. Loved his film against lower spin teams.
But, yeah. Spin move. Yeah. He had a phenomenal spin move. Didn't have anything else.
He couldn't do it against the bigger teams. I just remember, like, I loved his spin move so much. And then I think we were playing Arizona and former Dolphin Charles Clay, who couldn't block at all. Literally, Charles Harris went to do the spin move and he got stopped in mid motion by Charles Clay. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably a problem. He probably is not going to make it in the NFL.
Got to have more than that, man. You can't just have the one move. We usually hit on guys that have just the bull rush. Like that's all they have is a bull rush. But when you have a guy that has a good spin move, that's enticing. Because spin moves are fun.
Yeah. So one of the people in our Discord was asking this. He was curious because as the NFL and football in general is leaning more towards the smaller, more athletic players, have you had to adjust the guidelines for RAS or how you're grading the different positions at all? And if you so, how often do you do that?
No, but I don't think I'll need to. RAS is a relative score, so it's always comparing against the position group. And yes, we're going to have the bigger players from years past, but I think the amount that the NFL has trended downwards in terms of size is kind of overstated. I posted a few days ago about how defensive tackles have gotten smaller since 2014. And while that's true, it's only by a few pounds. I had to limit the graph that I was showing just to be able to actually show that there was a difference. I had to make it only like 15 or 20 pounds to show the difference over time, because it just doesn't vary all that much. And it's the same is true for tight end, which is another position that's been getting progressively smaller. the bigger tight ends tend to still last in the NFL. It's just they become offensive tackles or extra blockers. You know, they're still successful in the NFL. They're just not being used as receivers. The smaller guys are. And we don't have enough data yet to know if that's a permanent trend or if it's just something that's part of the NFL's cyclical nature. I think the defensive tackle thing is here to stay. I think they are going to stay progressively smaller just because I think teams kind of understand that it's more than just size, that the rest of those traits play a bigger deal. Tight end, there's a lot of really athletic, big tight ends. So that could be a permanent trend, or it might go right back to, you know, where it's you prioritize the bigger guys as well. We'll know in a few years, I think.
Yeah, I know for a while it seemed like the trend was try and make a safety into a linebacker, and it seems like that kind of died out real quick too.
Yeah, that went the way of the Wildcat offense, where it was kind of almost a fad. And then now it's actually a good example because a lot of teams have implemented that as part of their defense. It's just a package deal. It's not a, you know, full-on defense. And I know I keep using the Lions, but the Lions, back when they had Jim Schwartz as their head coach from 2009 to whatever it was, they built their entire defense around the wide nine, which is just a formation. Like, it's just a formation. Yeah. It's not a whole defense, but they tried to make that their whole defense. Sometimes things are just part-time. They're not every time. It's just a part-time thing. You can't do it all the time.
Yeah. We had for a couple of years under Adam Gase, we had a Jim Schwartz disciple, Matt Burke, is our defensive coordinator, who's now with Houston. He tried to make the wide nine a thing here too. And it didn't go well. It literally became the only thing that worked was a double A gap blitz. Mm-hmm. So,
which is the best part of a wide nine. And it has nothing to do with the wide nine. It's because of where you're creating your space. The wide nine is built to be, for those who aren't familiar, a wide nine is where you set your defensive end outside of the nine position on the line, which is outside of the tight end. You set them as far away from the line as you can, which either forces an offense to spend more players trying to block you, or to keep an extra blocker back because you're not going to be hit at the line, and that defensive end is going to have a head of steam by the time somebody gets a hand on him. That is great for, like, long distance passes. Like, you're third and 15, fine, do something like that and hope that they can't scramble. But the moment you face any kind of mobile quarterback, wide nine is toast. If a quarterback can move at all, you're done. You can't use the wide nine against them because there's just too much space there.
Just to kind of play off of that, because we're talking about fads, is there anything else you noticed with, like, drafting players that looked like it was becoming a trend but just kind of fell away to become a fad in recent years?
I think the super tiny scat back thing has kind of gone the way of the dodo. We had a few years where guys were drafted like Dry Archer and things like that from Kent State, where these guys were, like, super undersized and super fast, you know, plenty of athleticism there. But that type of play doesn't really work in the NFL. The players in the NFL are just generally too athletic for that to really work. You have to have a certain level of speed over your competition for that type of a player to work, and you just don't get that in the NFL. Whereas in college, you're generally facing a lot of guys who are never going to touch you if you're that kind of athlete. And that kind of went away. You know, we had a couple of teams that still do it every now and again, but it generally doesn't work. You know, those guys just don't hold up to punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as you mentioned that, I remember that. It's like, oh yeah, between day three came, every team's like, we got to get that guy who can pass block. He can just kind of throw a swing route or a screen to him. And like you said, now that I think about it, as you were talking, I'm like, I don't remember who the last scat back would be that anybody was really hyping up in the draft. Jordan, do you have an idea?
Because all they do now is they find a running back, like an actual running back, who can catch. Now you've done everything that guy could do. Like, all the stuff he could do, you've covered. And you don't have to spend additional capital on a guy who can barely take a hit.
And that right there is why I'm shocked that Braylon Allen, and this is a weaker running back class, But that's a reason why I think that Braylon Allen is going to get drafted in a position that people are going to be like, wow, I didn't realize a running back was going to get drafted that high. I think a team like the Packers makes a ton of sense for Braylon Allen to replace Aaron Jones. And he would also essentially replace Aaron Jones and eventually A.J. Dillon, because you're taking what the both of them do well and kind of combining them. So he's kind of, to me, the future, because before it was those bigger backs couldn't catch, couldn't get out in space. Now the bigger running backs can do what the smaller running backs can do and more. So I think in order for a small running back to break through and come back, I think they need to have an elite trait like a Devon Achane, who can just, you give him the ball and he has a chance to score. I think unless you have real legitimate home run hitting ability, I think NFL teams can find the same athletic ability with size. I think, Kent, I think you said it perfectly earlier. Hold on.
All inductees.
He's still working at school, so we'll give him a second there.
But what I was saying was, you said it perfectly earlier, where coaches are cocky. They believe that they can build anybody up. So if you're telling a coach that, especially an NFL coach, that they can coach a kid or coach a man at this point in the NFL that is 5'10", 180, or you can coach a guy that's 6'1", 210 with the same exact measurables, they're going to take the bigger kid every time, unless there's some reason when you sit down in a meeting room to really go with that smaller guy. So I think we're entering an age where, and it's not just in football, because I think you look at basketball, and I think the days of the 6'2" shooting guard is going out of the window. I think now teams, there are a lot of NBA teams that are starting point guards that are 6'5", 6'6", 6'7". And I think you're going to see the same thing transition to football, where positions are just going to, the athleticism is going to stay the same or get greater, but the sizes are going to go up and up and up.
Yeah, and what's odd is that I think the minimum weight for like what people consider a starting running back in the NFL has probably gone down a little bit. But I think the minimum weight that teams will draft a running back has gone up. I think teams don't want the really tiny guys, but they're willing to accept a guy that's about 200. Because that used to be like, even at 199, that was like a red flag for a lot of teams. It's like, oh God, I can't, he's never going to make it in the NFL. And I think teams are seeing like, you can get a guy with that kind of weight and be perfectly fine with him and not have any issues. But at the same time, that is a very narrow window in terms of weight, because it doesn't take very long before you are in that, okay, that's too small, right? We're okay with a guy that's a little bit small, but that too small you hit pretty quickly. So I think that window is gotten smaller over the last few years in terms of what teams will accept.
And Kent, the last question I had for you, and it's going to stick on the trends, because as a numbers guy, you tend to see things before anybody else does. You see trends before a lot of people do. So looking at how the last couple of years have gone, and it may have not reflected yet in the players yet, what are some trends you expect to see within the next, we'll say, 2 to 3 years with where teams go with players? It can be any position you want. It can be multiple positions. But what are you noticing that may not be noticeable for many people yet?
It's a tough one, because there's quite a few like nuanced things that are kind of going on that, like you said, most people don't really pay attention to, because it doesn't really matter. And because NFL players hit at such a ridiculously low rate, like it would be really nice if we could say like, yeah, you know, 40% of drafted players are going to be good. 40% of first rounders aren't even going to be good. Like the hit rate for a wide receiver in the first round is only 20%. So 1 in 5, 4 out of 5 are going to fail. That's first round receiver. That's not a good hit rate. So it's tough to look at things and be like, oh yeah, this is a good trend that we're going to start noticing, right? I think that teams have kind of gotten away from how important arm length is at offensive tackle. But weirdly enough, it's gotten more important on the interior. I've seen a lot of people complaining, people meaning connected circles with teams. Talking about length for interior offensive linemen, I hear that almost as often as I used to hear it for outside guys. But I think Joe Thomas being as successful as he was for as long as he was kind of put that arm length question, kind of turned it on its head and made people kind of reevaluate what it means to have, you know, shorter arms. Because it isn't really about, oh, your arm length is X, you're not going to be a good player. Teams care about length. And length is not just the length of your arms. It's the length that you're able to create. And being an explosive offensive lineman, a quick offensive lineman, that adds length. You see that on outside guys as well in cornerbacks. You know, if a cornerback has shorter arms, which used to be a huge red flag, hasn't been as big of a flag in recent years because they'll just get guys that are really quick or really explosive and they can make up whatever distance that matters. You know, we always refer to the NFL as a game of inches, and it really is, because it does not take a lot to create a few inches of separation just using math, just looking at the length of a guy's arms, the speed that they're running at, their change of direction ability. All of those things can create space, can create those inches that you need. And teams are getting a lot better at identifying guys who are able to overcome what we've normally perceived as deficiencies. I think arm length is probably the biggest one of those. I don't think it's ever going to not be an issue. And I think there's a point where it's still a problem. You know, it's still an issue. But I think that teams are kind of going away from caring as much about it. I also think that height for offensive linemen is a thing that people don't, I think that's already here. I don't think teams actually care about height on the offensive line all that much anymore. Used to be you were under 6'5", you're not a tackle, you're a guard. That's not the case anymore. And it hasn't really been for a while. It also used to be if you're over like 6'3.5", 6'4", you can't be a guard or a center because you're too tall for the quarterback to see over. Smaller quarterbacks have not had an issue, and then we started seeing guards get bigger. You know, guards are generally larger now than they used to be in terms of height. And I think that's a trend that's going to stay. I think teams have figured out that was just a thing that they thought was a thing and turned out to not be a thing. So that one I think is going to be here to stay.
I know Brett said that he's just about done, but I want to know, before we get off of here, when you've gone through, are there any players right now that you've identified for this upcoming draft that you think are far underslotted or overslotted that you really like, that people listening right now should be looking forward to their teams possibly drafting on draft night?
Not a specific player, but I would note a specific trend in this draft overall, which is just that this is a very athletic interior offensive line class, just in general. And I'm not talking about the class overall, because once we hit the pro day circuit, the average for everything drops significantly. But the higher rated offensive linemen on the interior are all pretty strong athletes. Three of the top five players for Raz are guards for 2024, and four of the top 10 are guards. That's notable. You have Graham Barton from Duke is the highest ranked Raz in the class right now. And he's one of the highest ranked offensive linemen in the class. Brandon Coleman out of TCU, very high athletic testing, rated fairly highly. Mason McCormick out of South Dakota State, I think is going to go a lot higher than a lot of people projected him to. One guy that I would say I think is going to get drafted that I don't think people were expecting to get drafted is Justin Strong out of Southern Illinois. Phenomenal testing at a 9.96 RAS. And I think he's a guy that pretty much nobody had on their radar. At least I had never heard people talking about him before he was able to put up that kind of testing. But other than that, I mean, there's a lot of guys that we were already kind of talking about whose testing got them pushed up. Ricky Pearsall out of Florida got a pretty decent bump, but I think he was probably going to get that anyway when he got drafted. And then Tip Ryman out of Illinois, viewed mostly as a blocking tight end, but ended up testing out as one of the most athletic tight ends in the class. That had to do a lot to help his stock. And we've seen guys like that get drafted much higher. The Bengals, I can't remember anybody's name today, but the Bengals drafted a guy in the second round a couple years ago that wasn't even viewed as a day two prospect, and they drafted him in the second round, drafted as a blocking tight end. that high because he had all those athletic traits, and teams think that they can use that in different ways. So guys like that, I think, are going to get pushed up boards because teams like to think that they can build on those existing traits and try to do something more with them. And sometimes they're successful. You know, it's not, you know, they think they can, but they can't. You know, having that ability does give them an advantage.
Two names that you said right at the beginning of that when talking about the interior offensive line. First of all, Mason McCormick. I know that he's a guy that a lot of people in the Dolphins circles and in our Discord like and kind of saw as an option if the Dolphins didn't take a offensive lineman in the first couple rounds, a guy that they could potentially even come up and get. And now it seems like in order to get him for the Dolphins, you essentially have to take him at 55. And then the other one is Graham Barton. Graham Barton, our same producer that we were talking about before, I believe Graham Barton is probably in his top two favorite prospects in the draft and might not be number two. But then we did our mock draft on listpodcast.com where we had 32 people on, and not a single one of the 32 picked Graham Barton in the first round. And multiple times Brett and I have talked about since how that was the most surprising part of our draft is that a guy that we liked the Dolphins at 21 in Graham Barton, nobody picked in the first round. So when it comes to Graham Barton specifically, do you see him as a surefire first-round pick? And when it comes to Mason McCormick, do you think – when you say he's going to get drafted higher than people think, how high do you think? Do you think saying that Mason McCormick is now a top 75 player is overreacting?
So to answer your second question first, I don't think that's overreacting, and I think that's probably fair. We never want to overreact because of the testing. You've heard people say, like, don't count it twice. If you think a guy's going to be athletic and he tests athletic, don't move him up your board. I think the thing with Mason McCormick is that he wasn't really viewed – he was kind of an unknown commodity for most people. NFL teams have probably had a much bigger handle on that, and they probably weren't as surprised with his testing as we were. I think it's just the national media kind of catching up at that point. For Graham Barton, I think the thing that hurts him the most is actually a positive, which is that he's a very versatile offensive lineman. He can play tackle, he can play guard, he can play center. I have him listed as a guard. He played center for a little bit in his college career. He played tackle for a good portion of it. He's mostly viewed as an interior offensive lineman coming into the draft. He'll probably start as a tackle coming into the NFL, unless he's drafted by a team that already has two. He'll probably start at tackle and swing inside if he can't handle it, which is what you should do. If you draft a guy that has played tackle and is that athletic, put him at tackle first. It's the more important position. See if they can work there. I think that's what's really hurting him, at least in the view of fans and the national media, is that it's a lot easier to draft a guy if you know what you're going to do with him. And Barton falls into that realm where not everybody's going to know what to do with him, because he could go anywhere on the line. And it's easier to just pick a guy who's specialized in that area, right? Pick a guy who's known for being a tackle, put him at tackle. Pick a guy who's known for being a guard, put him at guard. Barton's not really known for those things. He's known as being a versatile guy that can move around and do anything. So it kind of hurts him in that bit. NFL teams, though, I think are going to value that very highly.
Just had two questions pop up. One, I've gotten multiple messages. I was told to ask you your opinion on Miles Cole.
Miles Cole is a little bit of an outside case because he falls into that category of unproductive guys with ridiculous testing, right? I think his testing probably did push him up in some people's, like, actual teams, I think, might have actually moved him up because of his testing, because I don't think that it shows up quite as much on his tape. I've only been able to watch a few games from him, and it flashes at times. But he's a very wild player. He's very unrestrained in the way that he uses that athleticism, and it bites him a lot. He's got a lot of work that needs to be done. He's a very developmental player, probably a day three guy, and I think firmly a day three guy for me. Maybe a team eats that up in round three, but I think that's probably a guy that's going to go in the early day three from a team that thinks that they can develop it.
And this one is more for my co-host Jordan here, because I know it's an argument he's gotten into a lot. One of his favorite players is Kansas State tight end Ben Sinnott. And the one argument he gets into is There are some people saying
the only argument I get into.
Yeah,
the I only am a argument. Calm, cool, and collected right. guy. Cat, I never argue.
They, with anybody. People in our Discord are saying Sanaad's future is not at tight end; it's at fullback. And they say he plays like a fullback. He looks like a fullback. Jordan's mindset is the only reason people think that is because of the number he wore. If he wore like 85, he'd be viewed as one of the top tight ends in the draft. So wanted to see where you fell on that.
So if you're saying that a tight end is probably a fullback in the NFL, that is generally a derogatory thing, right? Not because you necessarily have an agenda against fullbacks, but fullbacks are like a 15 snap a game position. Even for teams that use fullback fairly routinely, have a good fullback. Kyle Juszczyk is a fantastic player, but they're able to scheme for him because he is a phenomenal fullback. There's a lot of things that you can do with him that you can't do with anybody else. But when somebody says, oh yeah, he's probably a fullback, they're not talking about Kyle Juszczyk. They're talking about whatever your team's fullback is. And most people can't even name their fullback.
Alec Ingold is a damn good fullback, Kent.
The Lions' fullback last year was Malcolm Rodriguez because they had enough good linebackers, but he was a good enough player that they're like, crap, we got to do something with him. I guess we'll make him a fullback for now so we can get him on the field because he's that good. That's still a very low snap position. I don't think Sanaad is a fullback. There's another position that isn't really tight end, which is an H-back, which is a type of tight end. They're generally on the smaller side. They're not your traditional inline blocking tight end that they can move out. They're usually the guys that are going into motion from the line out to the slot. That's kind of that role. I think that's probably what they generally mean when they're saying they don't think he's a tight end. They're not really meaning that they think he should be a fullback. They're probably meaning it's more like an H-back type where he's going to move around and find different positions on the line. And I think that's a fine projection for a guy like Sanaad. I think that's something you could do with him. You can still find those mismatches and take advantage of his athleticism. He's still going to be facing a linebacker or a safety most of the time. So you can still do the same types of things with him. But if you think a tight end is a fullback, you think he's an undrafted free agent that you can sign and maybe roster if you want to. It's generally a negative thing.
Yeah. I'm one of the minority. I actually think this tight end class is better than last year's tight end class. There are so many tight end prospects I like.
That's wild. Last year's tight end class was insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, remember they
were very high on this year.
Sorry to bring up the Lions, but you brought up tight end. The Lions had literally the best tight end rookie season ever.
Yeah. Well, aside from Laporta. I think after Laporta, you're looking Cade Stover, Sanaad. I do like Jaheim Bell, just he tested poorly. Theo Johnson, AJ Barner. A lot of guys who I just don't think got the love and the attention that last year's did. Another guy I really like is Colorado State's Dalen Halker. He seemed to test really well, and every time I look at his tape, there's definitely.
I know Holker's a guy that has quite a few fans in scouting circles too. I've seen people that have him rated as low as like a priority free agent type. I think he's probably going to go early day three. He's a guy I think has quite a few fans.
Yeah. Well. This has been a very fun and informative episode, Kent. This is like one of my favorite.
What I go done. For, like, fun and
honestly,
informative.
No, it's very informative. Like even when I missed, like before my computer crapped out on me, I actually said your RAS work is a lot like to me, the NFL's version of Moneyball, and it's definitely helping to inform stuff. So I've really enjoyed this. I found this very, like I've learned a lot of stuff that I kind of thought, but then how you've explained it. Is making me think about prospects a little differently.
Well, it's just like when you're trying to find a guy that matches tape and testing, you know, you can think a thing all you want. It's much better to have some confirmation about it, right? To be able to say, you know, I always thought this thing, but I didn't really have anything backing it up. Now I kind of have a better idea because there's some data behind it. That's analytics. That's what analytics is finding data, not just to support the things that you think, because you never go into it with an answer. You go into it with a question. And then you just find the answer to that question. And if it happens to line up with the things you already thought, bonus. That's those wins that you get to take.
Yeah, Ken, I thought this was awesome. I would love to have you back on after the draft and kind of recap. We'll talk about your Lions for sure. We'll plug them. Talk about our Dolphins and see who you think had a good and a bad draft. But again, I thank you for coming on. Everybody that is watching right now, please check him out at on X at MathBomb and check out his system at RAS.football. Kent, before we let you go, is there anything else? We have 470 people here. Anything else you want to plug, promote, you want the people to support, go look at? This is your floor to give them anything you want to give them.
Yep, you already mentioned RAS.football. Like I said, I've been running this for a long time. It's always good to go support the site. I also run the Pro Football Network Mock Draft Simulator. We just launched the multiplayer support, so the first multiplayer mock draft sim out there. I wasn't involved in coding that part. I don't get to claim that specific part, but I do maintain that sim, and I've had a lot of fun putting it together and maintaining it for the last few years. And everybody loves running mock draft sims anyway. So go check some of that stuff out.
You're talking to two people who've run 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
You can run 1,000 more of them, and you can complain if it doesn't work. Now you've got a face to put behind at least one of them.
a face with a beautiful, beautiful mustache.
Remember that if you want to complain about something, that mustache is going to come at you.
That's amazing. Kent, thank you again for coming on. This was a lot of fun. We really appreciate it. And enjoy draft season, and good luck to your Lions in a couple weeks here.
Thanks, guys. Have a great one.
Thank you.